Hello. Welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa bringing you the News Gazette on this Wednesday, June 11th, 2025. Hope you're having a great day so far. We'll start on the front page. There's a large picture in the center of the front page with the caption, REO Speedwagons, Bruce Hall and his wife Kimmy Hall reminisce during an appearance Tuesday with radio personalities Mike Hale and L.A. Fredrickson on WKIO 105.5 FM in Champaign. The couple discussed their favorite REO songs during a four-hour afternoon program after earlier appearances on WDWS 1400 AM and 94.9 FM and WHMS 97.5 FM ahead of Saturday's concert at the State Farm Center. And there's an article that follows by Bob Asmussen about this REO reunion. But first, we're going to cover at the top of the page from the University of Illinois an article about Trump by Jana Wiersema. Trump targets two USDA labs on campus for closure. For more than 50 years, the University of Illinois flagship campus has housed two U.S. Department of Agriculture labs that study and seek to address challenges that beset crop production. However, that could soon be changing. Under President Donald Trump's proposed budget for fiscal year 2026, agricultural research service units on campus would be closed and consolidated, with facilities in Peoria, Columbia, Missouri, and Ames, Iowa. Part of the reason that it's really important that that doesn't happen is that, first, the co-location of these scientists at the University of Illinois multiplies ARS impact, said Adam Davis, head of UIUC's Department of Crop Sciences and a former ARS employee. So Illinois leads the nation in soybean production with almost 11 million acres of soybeans planted each year. Central Illinois is home to the farmers, researchers, and seed companies who rely on these resources daily. He added that ARS scientists constantly partner with UIUC researchers and also help train students. Davis noted that the two impacted ARS units have been located on campus for 56 years. The Soybean Maize Germplasm Pathology and Genetics Research Unit employs five scientists and about 12 staff members, while the Global Change and Photosynthesis Research Unit employs two scientists and approximately 10 staff members. The latter has been world-renowned for decades and developed a lot of fundamental science of photosynthesis in crop plants. They've developed a lot of the fundamental science, and their work helps support efforts to improve crop yields, Davis said. Per the unit's website, its mission is to identify factors that impact food and bioenergy crops with an emphasis on global environmental change. The soybean and maize germplasm unit, on the other hand, is home to vast collections of different genotypes of both soybean and corn. In fact, the soybean germplasm unit is the largest collection of its kind in the world, Davis said. It's a living collection where the scientists grow out a portion of it every year, he said. These lines come from all over the world. Many of them were also developed here as a result of breeding, but then there are also the original lines that were collected in field conditions in countries around the world. And then the Maize Genetics Cooperation Stock Center also keeps alive a rare mutant collection. Closing the labs here could be disruptive and costly, Davis said. So, as I said, these are living collections, and if the collections were to be moved, there would be an enormous amount of logistics associated with it, and no guarantee that all of the lines would actually make it through. He also noted that relocating ARS employees would likewise be disruptive for their families and the community at large. When asked why the relocation was proposed, Davis replied that he had absolutely no idea. However, he noted that the proposed budget has also included the closure of facilities in Delaware and California. Perhaps you can connect the dots between those locations and the intent of the closures, Davis said. The USDA's summary of the proposed ARS budget for fiscal year 2026 does not provide a reason for the proposed closures and consolidations, though the agency did state plans to reduce overall staff in pursuit of streamlining workforce efforts, facilities, and other government efficiencies. They've already made large staffing cuts by encouraging employees to leave due to the uncertainty caused by the DOGE layoffs, Davis said. Although some of the employees who were laid off were reinstated, quite a few chose to leave rather than continue to be subjected to the disrespect and professional uncertainty. The Trump administration wrote in its budget proposal that it is committed to prioritizing research that supports American agriculture. However, many of the current ARS facilities are in disrepair, officials wrote. The budget reduces funding for research sites across the nation that have exceeded their ideal lifespan and reduces funding for research projects that are not of the highest national priority. However, Davis said that local facilities are far from outdated, especially given recent upgrades to the germplasm collection in particular. This includes a $300,000 20 degrees Celsius seed vault made to protect seeds for over 30 years and cold rooms that can store up to 40,000 soybean lines. He added that ARS has an index it uses to grade the conditions of its various facilities, and the soybean germplasm collection scored 96 out of 100. ARS infrastructure here is built, tested, and paid for, making relocation a waste of taxpayers' resources, Davis concluded. Also on the front page, an article from Champaign County Court by Luke Taylor. Scientists say DNA ties suspect to murder weapon. A man who was acquitted of homicide less than a year ago returned to the courtroom this week as he stands accused of an entirely different murder. Zaire Herman, 22, of Champaign, was charged with four counts of first-degree murder and one of felon possession of a weapon after a shooting incident on March 16th of this year. At least 19 rifle shots were fired at a van in the Oakwood Trace apartment complex, two of which authorities say struck 31-year-old Anthony Miller and led to his death the following day. Forensic pathologist Nate Patterson, who completed the autopsy, testified on Tuesday and explained how a bullet that grazed the back of the victim's skull and another that struck his shoulder led to his death. The projectile that struck his shoulder hit bone and fragmented, getting caught in blood vessels and causing damage as far up as the victim's neck. Patterson also identified where he believed surgeons were trying to save Miller's life, grafting in a blood vessel from another part of his body. Much of the security footage of the shooting incident is distant, revealing little of what happened, but a masked subject can be seen running from the scene. Based partly on footage of the individual wearing black pants with white circular markings, pants that Herman also owns, investigators believe he is the masked subject. His DNA was also identified on a Smith & Wesson M&P-15 and an AR-15-style rifle found on a Beardsley Avenue rooftop less than a block from the scene of the shooting. Illinois State Police forensic scientist Kelly Majewski explained how she compared DNA found on the weapon to swabs from the inside of Herman's cheek. Various locations on the rifle had DNA from multiple unknown individuals, but all had a very high likelihood of including Herman. Another forensic scientist with the state police, Hallie Carls Miller, testified the rifle against a projectile and the numerous cartridge cases, also called bullet casings, found on the scene. By firing a test round and comparing microscopic dents and grooves, she determined that all 19 casings were fired by the Smith & Wesson. The rifle was not owned by Herman and had been reported stolen. Champaign Police Detective Stephen Vogel said that as far as he was aware, Herman was not on the list of suspects in the theft. Once a gun is stolen, it's used at least in this case and then passed around, and it changes hands multiple times, Vogel said. There was one direct eyewitness to the shooting, the driver of the van, But an officer said that he was not a forthcoming witness. Champaign Patrol Officer Kevin Birch was responsible for marking much of the evidence at the scene. In court, he pointed out in photos where the 19 casings were found, 7 of them next to the van where the shooting occurred, implying that the shooter was standing at very close range before moving away. The vehicle's windows were shattered, leaving broken glass inside and outside, and clothing items were left behind as medical personnel rushed the victim to an area hospital. This trial is set to continue and likely come to a close today. Last July, Herman was acquitted of the 2023 murder of Jalen A. Williams. In that case, he had arrived at an area hospital with gunshot wounds to his fingers 6 days after the victim was found dead. Investigators believe the pair had exchanged fire, but Herman said that his injuries were from a separate exchange, and jurors ultimately ruled in his favor. Now let's go back to the article about REO by Bob Asmussen. Can't fight this feeling. Take it on the run to this weekend's REO reunion. To bring iconic rock band REO Speedwagon back to its golden country Champaign Urbana, organizers had to roll with the changes. Luckily, they decided to keep pushing on while riding the storm out. Voila, just for you, a final performance by the legends where it all started. Thanks to the efforts of Central Illinois Multimedia Group executives Jody Parado and Paul Barrett, plus Radio's Mike Hale and L.A. Fredrickson, a special concert is Saturday at the State Farm Center. The one-time event is honoring the legacy of REO Speedwagon with a retrospective show featuring special guests and former band members. The headliners are Neil Doty, Alan Gratzer, Bruce Hall, Terry Luttrell, Mike Murphy, and Steve Scorfina, all who played vital roles in the band's success. The concert is being co-promoted by CIMG and State Farm Center. Long time coming. Of course, there's a story behind the concert, one that goes back several years. Shortly after CIMG bought the News Gazette and affiliated radio stations in the 2019 Parado met, in 2019, Parado met with then State Farm Center director Kevin Alstead. We talked about creating a co-promotion partnership with Champaign Multimedia and the State Farm Center, Parado said. They discussed an upcoming REO Speedwagon milestone, and Parado said he would like to get all the current and former band members together for an anniversary show. In March 2020, Parado and longtime WDWS WHMS personality Fredrickson attended an REO performance in Effingham. Afterward, Parado and Fredrickson met with the band members backstage. I threw out the idea, why don't we get something together, Parado said. But that was the last show before COVID shut down everything. The arrangement with State Farm Center was put on hold because there were no concerts for a couple of years. It all went away, Parado said. A year ago, Parado revived the REO idea, reaching out to the individual band members. We got all the guys together and put it together, he said. It just took time. Some of the band members had been away from REO for decades. It was just contacting and talking to them, Parado said. In December, they had a group phone call. That's when it really started setting into motion that we would actually do this, Parado said. A promoter from downstate Illinois, Ditto Basso, helped turn the dream into reality. These were people that have run major tours in the past, Parado said. He understood the inner workings. His institutional knowledge of the business and how these things work was what really kept everything together. Basso's history in the industry added to the comfort for the REO members. Counting down. The show is a few days away, and Parado can't wait. We're excited for the fans and the band, he said. They get to come back and do this, and fans get to see them one last time. That's just exciting. Proceeds from the concert will go to the Moffitt Cancer Center in Florida, which is a cause for the REO Speedwagon Foundation. People should come out and see it, Parado said. This is a one-off deal. There won't be another one of these. Parado is a longtime REO fan. In the 70s, there were bars in Carbondale named Merlin's and Bonaparte's Retreat. As a young guy, I saw REO down there, Parado said. The REO concert won't be the last co-promoted by CIMG and the State Farm Center. For Illinois Homecoming, they're working together on a show with the Steve Miller Band, and more to follow. We're partnering with the university to try to bring back world-class entertainment to Champaign and Central Illinois, Parado said. CIMG is working with current State Farm Center Director John Marquardt. It's kind of cool, actually, Parado said. CIMG runs the longtime flagship stations for Illinois sports broadcasts. It's been a good relationship that we're continuing to expand and grow, Parado said. Filling up. At the State Farm Center, the REO show is using what is called the North End setup. That leaves two-thirds of the arena seats available, plus spots on the floor. There won't be an opening act. The concert will start with Luttrell's current band playing the first two songs. During the second number, original guitar player Scarfina will join in, followed by a third song. Two REO members who have passed away, Peoria native Gary Richrath and Greg Philbin, will be honored. Then the full band will play Ridin' the Storm Out. It'll be the first and last concert of its kind. The show will run about 2 hours with all the REO hits in the lineup. The band will be in the area most of the week preparing for the concert. The band members plan to visit their old stomping grounds in CU. REO Speedwagon formed in the late 1960s, and they had multiple hits in the 70s and 80s. The band's High Fidelity sold more than 10 million copies. High Infidelity. And that should be an exciting concert. Let's jump over to J. Mark Powell and his Holy Cow history. And there's a very old picture, a vintage picture of Sarah Rosetta Wakeman, who posed as Private Lyons Wakeman, shown in her Union Army uniform. She served with Company H, 153rd New York Volunteer Infantry, during the Civil War. And there's also a picture of a headstone of Lyons Wakeman, the alias of Sarah Rosetta Wakeman, at her final resting place in Chalmette National Cemetery in New Orleans, where she died of disease while serving in the ill-fated Red River Campaign. A soldier's big secret. At first glance, there was nothing unusual about Private Lyons Wakeman. The service record in the National Archives is similar to countless other Civil War soldiers. Age 21, height 5 feet, color fair, complected with brown hair and blue eyes. About as typical as it gets for a soldier of that era. With one significant exception. When one of Wakeman's descendants died in 1976, relatives poking around in the deceased's attic came upon a stash of old letters. When they read them, not only was the content shocking, but the family tree had to be rewritten as well, because Lyons Wakeman was actually Sarah Rosetta Wakeman, a veteran of the Civil War. She was born in 1843, the eldest of 9 children of a farmer couple in southern New York. Life on an antebellum family farm was anything but easy. Everyone pitched in. The hours were long, and the pay was lousy, when there was any. With her parents struggling to make ends meet, Sarah worked as a domestic servant on the side. In her teens, she realized getting married would mean one less mouth to feed at home. However, there was apparently a shortage of prospective suitors. Making matters worse, it seems there was a nasty spat between Mom and Dad and their oldest daughter. Sarah did what teens sometimes do. She ran away from home. With very little cash on hand and no means of support, as an unskilled single woman with a minimal education, her prospects were bleak. Desperate times, they say, call for desperate measures, and Sarah was very desperate indeed. So she tried something radical for her time. She put on a pair of pants and a shirt, parted her hair on the side, and changed her first name to Lyons. From that moment on, and for the rest of her short life, she passed as a man. The rift with her parents must have patched up to a certain extent, but not enough to return home, but enough to reassure them their fears and keep them updated on her life, because Sarah wrote frequently and honestly. While she was busy living a lie, she was honest with them. She worked as a boatman on the Shenango Canal, Then, in August of 1862, something intriguing caught her eye. An army recruiting poster offered a $300 bounty, equivalent to nearly $11,000 today, to those who volunteered. It must have seemed like a fortune to her. And so, Lyons Wakeman enlisted in Company H, 153rd New York Volunteer Infantry, giving her age as 21 and thus a legal adult. She was given a blue uniform and a rifle and marched off to the front. The 153rd was first stationed outside Washington, D.C., part of the massive array of troops defending the Capitol. Army life suited her. "I like to be a soldier very well," she wrote. Her letters home often contained cash. Maybe it was meant to help the large family make ends meet. Perhaps it was an atonement for having run off in a huff. Perhaps a little bit of both. At one point, she was assigned to help guard Carroll Prison, whose inmates included three women arrested after trying to pass themselves off as men to join the Union Army. The irony was not lost on Sarah, neither was the risk. She knew all too well that if her true gender and her identity were discovered, she could wind up behind bars with them. She never pretended to be anything but Sarah in her letters home, either, which also carried a risk of exposure if her writings were ever intercepted, though back then there were no censors reading soldiers' letters. Everything changed in February of 1864, when the 153rd was ordered to the banks of the Mississippi River in Louisiana. It took part in the disastrous Red River Campaign that spring, which General William T. Sherman called one damn blunder from the beginning to end. Sarah fought bravely in the Battle of Pleasant Hill. "I feel thankful to God that he spared my life, and I pray to him that he will lead me safe through the field of battle and that I may return home safely," she wrote in one of her letters. But it was not to be. Like many northern soldiers fighting in the hot Delta climate, she grew sick and taken to a military hospital in New Orleans, and she died there of disease on June 19, 1864. She rests today in Chalmette National Cemetery beneath a stone bearing the name she fought under, Lyons Wakeman. Of the 3.1 million Americans, North and South, who served in that war, it is believed that up to 1,000 were women posing as men. Sarah Rosetta Wakeman was one of several who never came back. Continuing on in our communities, an article from Urbana by Luke Taylor about Weber and Thies Legal Profession Boot Camp. Central students learn law from judge and local lawyers. After spending a day learning the basics of their potential career, seven prospective lawyers, all students at Central High, got a behind-the-scenes look at the Champaign County Courthouse. Each of the students had applied to be part of the Weber and Thies 2-day legal profession boot camp, giving them the chance to learn the different types of law and how to pursue becoming a lawyer. On Monday morning, the students heard from partners at Weber and Thies at their office, and on Tuesday they met Rita Garman, former Chief Justice of the Illinois Supreme Court. She joined the crew on a visit with Champaign County Judge Matt Lee. The teens got to sit in on a hearing in Lee's courtroom, but first they took the chance to pick his brain as a former prosecutor, then civil and defense attorney, and now judge. Lee spoke on his role in the courtroom, as well as his respect for attorneys on both sides of a criminal case, before opening to questions from the high schoolers. Some of the insights. How can a defense attorney defend someone that they know for a fact is guilty? Lee said that he served as private defense attorney, so he always had the option to turn down a client. Thinking about public defenders, though, he shared perspectives from his time as a prosecutor and judge, saying that in many ways, the prosecutor is the most powerful person in a courtroom, with the ability to press charges or dismiss cases. Having a defense attorney provides balance, especially when it comes to the sentencing. "This is the best system, I believe, in the world," Lee said, of the U.S. judicial system. How do you know the right sentence for a crime? Legal expertise and personal experience, Lee said, along with the factors presented by prosecutors and defense attorneys. "That's probably my hardest task," he said. "There's no easy answer about how to make the right decision." He did have some advice: get a good night's sleep and leave your personal drama and ego outside of the courtroom. Are there any trials or cases that haunt you? "Children are the most vulnerable section of our society," Lee said. Cases he dealt with in civil court involving custody issues and child abuse stay with him even more than the criminal cases that he tries now. "What was your experience like as a person of color in law school and in the legal profession?" Lee looked back on his reasons for pursuing law. He wasn't mathematically or medically inclined, and the guys in A Few Good Men seemed to be having fun, so law school it was. Lee himself was born in Taiwan and said that his parents live in China, where he feels the legal system is significantly worse. He encourages fellow people of color to get into the legal field because it could always use more diversity. "If you distinguish yourself as an excellent attorney, that usually transcends any other labels people could apply," Lee said. Even so, he said that diverse lawyers are more prepared to represent diverse clients, whether it be because they speak the same language or have a personal understanding of their shared culture. And there's a great picture at the bottom of this article with the local law firm, Weber & Theis, and that crew that they brought in. And they are named here as Ferris Gull, Sarah Benhemis, Lark Runkle, Amala Willenbrock, Maddox Todd, attorney Joseph Soling, Paola Oviedo, Jaden Sibley, attorney Daniel Theis, and former Chief Justice of the Illinois Supreme Court, Rita Garman. I'll also mention on this page there's no article following it, but there is a picture of a car crash closing in on the Social Security office. A car veered into a pillar at the Social Security Administration office at 101 South County Fair Drive in Champaign on Tuesday morning, causing significant damage outside the building. Emergency personnel were on the scene of the accident. The accident caused the office to close for the remainder of Tuesday. Champaign Police Department spokesman Joe Lamberson said that the car hit a traffic bollard rather than the building itself. No citations were issued. And I will try to quickly fit in an opinion piece by Jim Dye with the title, "Frustrated GOP Reps Again Challenge Legislating by Surprise." A day before the Illinois House and Senate were scheduled to adjourn, supermajority Democrats dropped a proposed $55 billion plus budget proposal on the desks of their GOP counterparts. The legislation consisted of 1.7 million words that covered 3,363 pages. The next day, over GOP opposition, Democrats approved the measure and sent it to Governor J.B. Pritzker to sign into law. Superminority Republicans can't do much in Springfield, but they can cry foul. That's what a group of them, members of the Conservative Freedom Caucus, did when they filed a Sangamon County lawsuit charging Democrats warp speed budget passage violates the explicit three readings rule in the Illinois Constitution that sets rules for passing laws. The lawsuit filed by Benton lawyer Brian Drew is most likely doomed because the Illinois Supreme Court has heard and rejected similar challenges on previous occasions. Nonetheless, the three readings rule, in all its embarrassing glory, is back in the public eye. Most people have, for good reasons, never even heard of it. After all, it is inside baseball, constitutional law style. But the subject keeps popping up in the lower court opinions that note its undeniable presence in the Illinois Constitution, Article 4, Section 8, Paragraph D, and questions why previous high court decisions refuse to acknowledge it. It reads, "A bill shall be read by title on three different days in each house. A bill and each amendment thereto shall be reproduced and placed on the desk of each member before final passage." An Illinois Supreme Court majority ignores dissenting Justice Lisa Holder White calls it turning a blind eye, the constitutional mandate, because it can. But its decision is to pretend that the three readings provision doesn't exist presents a growing stain on court that doesn't like to hang its dirty linen in public. Members of the Freedom Caucus are hoping this time the results will be different. The lightning might strike, but it looks like another futile act by a super minority party that has to rely on them to make a political point. And we're going to take a break here with our first half of the News Gazette. I will return shortly for the second half.